Welcome, podcast listeners. This week we talk money.
Jefferson wasn't a good manager of his own money, but he was a brilliant manager of the people's money. He was maybe the most fiscally severe and responsible president in the entire run of presidents in American history.
He had some good advice. We talked about that a bit in the show, but I was particularly interested in Albert Gallatin. Didn't know a lot about him, still don't know a lot about him, but it would seem that he was the guy, he was the nerd in the office really crunching numbers, if you look at some of the letters between he and Jefferson.
Well, they both understood that a national debt is a really bad idea, and
yeah, but somebody had to put all those numbers in columns and add them up and say, here they are, Mr. President, and I think it was him.
Gallatin was outstanding at this. Jefferson didn't really understand economics. He certainly didn't understand the details of economics, and so he chose this brilliant financier, Albert Gallatin, who was Swiss-born and French-educated. He was a Pennsylvania politician, disliked by the Federalists. They tried to deny him a place in Jefferson's cabinet. Jefferson appointed him by what's known as a recess appointment. But he turned out to be magnificent, and he was even maybe better than Hamilton. Hamilton set up the system, but Gallatin stabilized it.
That's kind of what I came away. We should probably talk about that sometime.
He's an amazing guy. He was, you know, Gallatin was also one of the fathers of the science of Indian language classification. So he actually had a system of, he gathered up vocabularies that partly Jefferson supplied and partly others did, and Gallatin developed a system. This is what the Enlightenment did and said, well, here's Cherokee and here's Algonquin and here's Iroquois and here's Seminole and here's Crow and here's Sioux and here's blah, blah, blah. And Gallatin said, let's look at this and see if we can classify them. Are there similarities between Crow, say, and Hidatsa? Are there similarities between Mandan and Lakota? If so, we can find underlying language groups from which these different tribal languages evolved. And he's still regarded as one of the four or five greatest figures in the history of Native American language classification, a subject close to your own heart.
With that, we can go to the show unless there's anything else you'd like to...
Just to say the two things. I'm going to Norfolk, to Newport News, in fact, on April 19th for a performance at the Ferguson Center for the Arts at the Diamondstein Concert Hall. That's Wednesday, April 19th. I want people to come. I love meeting my friends and listeners in the Chesapeake.
You know, we got an email from somebody who was trying to set up a meeting with you.
I saw that.
Yes. Are you going to respond to it?
Yes, I will. I certainly will. And then I also am doing the Becky Tour, the Lewis and Clark, the signature Lewis and Clark Cultural Tour. Go to the new website, which is fantastic, at oddytours.net, or go to jeffersonhour.org, and you can find out all about that tour. It's the 12th annual signature Clay Jenkinson Locksaw Lodge Missouri River Tour. In the footsteps of Lewis and Clark, it's July 18th through 27th, and it is really, if you've never done it, this is the year to do it. It's going to be a great year. We've had lots of snow in the mountains. The river's going to be running beautifully. I just can't wait to get out there and to huff and puff and to see the White Cliffs and to do the Wendover Death March for the 12th time.
Thanks very much for listening. We hope you enjoy this week.
Enjoy this podcast edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay Jenkinson. I'm your host, David Swenson, and seated across from me is President Thomas Jefferson. Good to see you, Mr. President.
Good day to you, citizen.
Mr. President, I always enjoy our conversations. Sometimes we talk about very pleasant things. Sometimes we talk about political things.
Sir, I'm beginning to feel a migraine headache come on.
Oh, no, Mr. President. I promise to keep this civil.
I count on you, sir.
I would like to talk to you about the Second American Revolution.
Yes, the year was 1800, and I called it the Second American Revolution.
And in particular, how you achieved what you wanted to do in an economic sense. In other words, I'd like to talk to you... Forgive me, but I'd like to speak to you today about the process of developing a federal budget. A president during my time said, no government ever voluntarily reduces itself in size. Government programs, once launched, never disappear. Actually, a government bureau is the nearest thing to eternal life we'll ever see on this earth.
I think, sir, I can honestly say that I was one of those few presidents who reduced the size of the national government of the United States. I inherited an $80 million national debt. I reduced it by $37 million during the two terms that I was president. I reduced the size of the Navy, although I kept it alive, and I made severe reductions in the Army, which I saw mostly as a force to protect our frontier settlements in the West, where there were often Indian depredations and clashes with Native peoples. But I wanted a bare-bones Army, a very slender Navy. I changed the procurement structure for the Navy so that we would not have large ships of the line, but rather gunboats and a fleet, I called it a mosquito fleet, for purely defensive purposes. And I also reduced all the unnecessary federal offices that I came upon. There weren't many. I think there were a little over 300 positions in the government that were named by the president, but I let some of them disappear by attrition. Then those that I must fill, I filled with veterans wherever possible. But my whole purpose as president was to cut government down to something like its statistical minimum and to insist that we pay our bills and balance our budgets and live within the means of the tax base of the United States. And because I feel so strongly that a national debt is a disgrace, to pay off every penny of the national debt that we can possibly pay off. So I think that if you study the history of the presidency, you will find profligate presidents and frugal presidents. But I can promise you, you will not find a more frugal public officer than I was.
You've touched on many things there, Mr. President, that I'd like to talk to you about in detail. But perhaps we could start at the beginning, in 1800, your second revolution. You stated that you wanted to work with the Federalists for the good of the nation. But I note, sir, that in choosing your cabinet, there were no Federalists included. They were all of your party, sir.
Well, you must surround yourself by men of your own stamp. It was bad enough to have federal judgeships filled by people who were my sworn enemies, some of whom had been packed into our judicial system at the very last minute. And that's why they're called midnight appointments. John Adams was literally running out of time in his one-term administration, and he was packing the court system with people who had life tenure to the extent that he could. Some of his commissions literally didn't get off the table and to the intended recipients, but he was working as hard as he possibly could to prevent the Second American Revolution by packing the courts with people who had a very different political outlook, many of whom were sworn enemies to me, at least politically and at times personally. And so that, I think, is a form of corruption, what John Adams did. It was one of the few things that I found hard to forgive in him. But given that, the legislative branch is none of my business. That's up to the people in individual states and in districts. But the executive branch, which, as I said, had a couple of hundred figures in it, mostly in the Treasury, the executive branch needed to move in a new direction to fulfill the vision of a second American Revolution, or at least what I call the Revolution of 1800. And so, of course, I put into my four cabinet positions, four and only four, people of my own political persuasion. To have put in a high Federalist like Timothy Pickering or Rufus King or John Jay or John Marshall, or for that matter, Colonel Hamilton, would have been to commit suicide politically. And you know that John Adams, when he became the second president, what he called the heir apparent to George Washington, made the fatal mistake of keeping Washington's cabinet. He should have filled the cabinet offices with his own people. In failing to do so, he left in place the Washington cabinet out of a sense of loyalty to the great man.
Mr. President, you're saying that you learned from the mistakes John Adams made.
Very much so. By maintaining the Washington cabinet, he thought he was showing respect to the greatest American, General Washington. But in fact, he did not know that the secret power behind that cabinet was Colonel Hamilton back in New York. That Hamilton had retired from government. He was now a lawyer in the city of New York, but that from afar, Hamilton was manipulating the Adams cabinet. Hamilton regarded himself as a sort of shadow president of the United States. Those cabinet ministers leaned on Hamilton for wisdom and perspective and did almost nothing without checking with their chief first. And when Adams found this out late in his one term, he was livid, as you might imagine, and he fired several members of his cabinet. But by then, it was too late. By then, his administration had been ruined by the machinations of the colonel from New York, Alexander Hamilton.
Just we're not so hard on your friend, Mr. Adams. You must give him a little slack there, Mr. President. It was these policies and how the government worked. It was all brand new then.
It was, and the cabinet is not a constitutional entity. So if you read your constitution, you will not find a secretary of the treasury or a secretary of state or a secretary of defense or war, as it was called in my time. Those are traditions in American government, but they're not enumerated positions from the Constitution of the United States. So at one point, we thought of calling this body a council of advisors, that they would somehow informally be useful to the president of the United States. We'd had a council in Virginia when I was governor. But then people decided that council was not quite the right term. And so slowly the term cabinet came into being. And George Washington then decided that he needed a few ministers to do certain things. He needed a minister to handle foreign affairs, and he named me his first Secretary of State. He needed a minister to handle the economy, fiscal affairs, the national debt, revenue, the printing presses, and so on. And that was, of course, Alexander Hamilton. He needed a Secretary of War. He did not have a Secretary of Navy because the Navy had not yet been invented, and he needed an Attorney General. And so all of these offices existed by imaginative creation of the first administration, the Washington administration. They have become, in your time, as deeply rooted in American life as the presidency and the vice presidency and the Senate. But I repeat, they have no constitutional base of any sort.
President Jefferson, history tells us, and you as well tell us, that you were very concerned about public debt, and your two closest advisors on these economic issues were Secretary of State James Madison and Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin. And if I understand correctly, they agreed that government spending as it had taken place during John Adams' administration must come to an end with the goal of paying all these debts off as quickly as possible. Am I correct?
Yes, let me back up a little bit and tell you our theory or our principle. I believe in liberty. I believe that that government is best which governs least. I believe such government as we must have should be local in its application. And that the closer the government is to the room in which you are hearing this, the more likely you are to be well governed. I was never in favor of a large national government. I prefer states. I think they're the better entity for handling almost all public affairs. Even as president, I called the national government the foreign department. That's number one, that I'm not a friend to energetic government. It is almost always oppressive. Number two, government is expensive. And not only is it expensive, but it begins to take out of the pocket of the workers money that the workers would rather not give to government. In other words, if government had to come to you each time it wanted to do something and say, we're going to build a school, we'll need $10. We're going to build a lighthouse, we need $30, etc. Then people would have the choice to determine what they wanted government to do and what they would rather that government not do. But under our system, we give a large body of money to the government, and then the government decides for itself what it thinks is in the interest of the American people. The problem with that is that all governments, no matter how virtuous they are at their inception, soon begin to do things that are not necessary and proper, that are not things absolutely needed by the people, things that might better be done by private enterprise, and things that might better be done at a state and local arena. So the second problem of a big government is that it becomes expensive and it spends people's money, forgetting that that money is the hard-earned cash of people who actually labor for a living, that this is not some sort of funny money or abstraction. This money comes out of the pockets of the citizens of the United States. And then the third issue is that government has a tendency to grow, to spread, to engulf a system, to invent functions, to think of good things that it might wish to do. But I remind you that government should do those things which government alone can do. If we had that standard, that government at all levels should do only those things that government alone can do, not things that we might think interesting, not things that would be useful, not things that are delightful to the people or loaves and fishes or subsidies or endowments for this and foundations for that. That's interesting And I admire some of those things, but they're not proper functions of a limited constitutional government in a republic.
Mr. President, you've defined probably the single biggest difference between the two political parties that exist during my time.
And I know that I'm right about this, that the people exist. They want to keep their money. They're willing, grudgingly, to allow some of that money to be used by government to do certain things, but they are not giving blank checks to government, and they do not want government to keep coming back and asking for more, and for government to invent purposes that are not absolutely necessary and proper to the civility and due process and general public happiness of the people of the United States. I could not feel more strongly about this. That government is best which governs least.
You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. We're going to take a short break, but we'll return in just a moment. Let's take advantage of this break between segments, Clay, because I would like to hear about Mr. Jefferson on the road.
As you know, we do the Jefferson Hour here on the Great Plains, but I love to take Jefferson on the road. That's how I started. And I'm going back to one of the places that I most enjoy performing at. That is Newport News at the Ferguson Center for the Arts, Wednesday, April 19th, 2017, 7:30 to 9 p.m., David.
I take it you've been to Newport News before.
Many times, and to Norfolk and Suffolk and Virginia Beach, etc. This is my favorite place to go. It's one of the headquarters of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, and I go back as many times as people invite me to come.
So, springtime in Virginia with Mr. Jefferson.
Springtime in Virginia. It'll be a little bit late for the blossoms. Mr. Jefferson's garden will be well advanced, but I will be ready to talk revolution.
Go to jeffersonhour.com for more information. And now let's return to the Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. And this week we're speaking with Mr. Jefferson about federal budgets. I apologize. I know it's probably not one of your favorite subjects, Mr. President.
It is a favorite subject of mine because I feel so strongly about it. When I became president, I would have liked to have done a very wide number of things. I would have liked to have been an activist president, to have a national museum, a national university, to support the arts, and to engage in internal improvements, canals and bridges and postal roads and so on. I'm fascinated by all of this, and I believe that an enlightened society does such things. But I couldn't do those because I'm a strict constructionist and I'm a believer in limited government. And so when I became the third president of the United States, I asked myself, what's the responsible thing for me to do? Not what would I like to do if I were a dictator or if I lived in some utopia, what might I want to create? But what is my responsibility?
Isn't it to listen to your constituency, to listen to the people, Mr. President?
Of course, but the primary responsibility of the executive is to adhere to the Constitution of the United States, to do those things that the Constitution has empowered the president to do and no more. And my own philosophy of government is less rather than more. If it can be done privately by a foundation, by a church, by a parish, by a group of volunteer citizens, or by a state or local government, that is to me infinitely preferable than for that function to be taken on by the national government of the United States. I want to create some sort of a leash between the sovereign, the people, and their agents in government. I don't believe those agents have a right to spend money recklessly for things they think are interesting. The Constitution is quite clear on this. It says necessary and proper. So if you ask yourself, take any government bureau or entity of your time, whether it's the post office or the War Department or things I could not even have anticipated, but take any single government entity and ask yourself, is it necessary? Is it proper? Was it anticipated and welcomed by the 55 men who met in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787? Did they contemplate this service or this bureau or this business of government to be funded by the taxpayers of the United States? And if you take on that standard, you will find that almost everything is unnecessary and, to that extent, improper.
Earlier, Mr. President, I talked about James Madison and Albert Gallatin, and I suspected that they were two of the men that really helped you in your economic policy. Now, I know you worked very hard. It's reported that you spent 10 to 13 hours a day in your office, that you were what we call today a hands-on president. You wanted to understand and know everything that was going on, and you would spend hours and hours and hours alone in your office, actually in the company of your mockingbird, working on these problems.
Yes, I was a very hard worker. I have a great sense of attention to detail. I'm a person who likes to control those circumstances that can be controlled, since there are so many in life that cannot. And I remind you that the cabinet is an invention of the executive branch. It's not something that is enumerated in the Constitution. So Albert Gallatin, although he was one of the most talented secretaries of finance in American history, I think more talented, frankly, than Alexander Hamilton, still was not constitutionally based. The Secretary of State, Mr. Madison, my closest friend and collaborator, my great ally in life, was my friend, and he served admirably, but he was not elected by the people to be the Secretary of State, and so on. So I wanted to make sure I was on top of all of the correspondence and all of the business of these bureaus, because I was the sole creature in this administration who had actually been elected by the sovereign, by the people of the United States. So I worked very hard at that, and I followed George Washington's system. He had insisted on seeing every important piece of correspondence. Adams had delegated to a greater extent. That was more Adams' style, and every president gets to choose his style. But I preferred Washington's protocols, and so I said that anything of more than very insignificant importance must cross my desk. Well, that kept me at my desk for 10, 12, sometimes 14 hours per day.
Quite busy, I understand, in working through all of these details.
The people of the United States did not elect me to be a man of leisure. They elected me to attend to their public business, and this is something I don't particularly enjoy. But I will say I'm a master at it, that I'm a master administrator. I can read a great deal. I have a tremendous amount of perseverance, stamina to sit there hour after hour. I have a graceful pen, a good memory, a great filing system. I'm attentive to detail. I believe that correspondence should be answered instantly if possible. I don't believe in leaving much on one's desk. And I think that to stay on top of a system even as simple as ours by comparison with yours required a very steady intelligence, that any president who doesn't spend 8, 9, 10, maybe 15 hours a day at the sheer business of administration, not giving speeches, not meeting with foreign ambassadors, not going out into the country to stump or to be seen, but actually doing the quiet and unglamorous work of administration, any president that doesn't want to do that has probably chosen the wrong profession.
Just to understand, Mr. President, the differences between your time and mine, and talking about the budget, during my time, it's accepted that Congress is the final say on the budget. In other words, a president provides a budget as sort of a blueprint for what he wants to achieve during his administration, and it's up to Congress to approve and provide the funds for this budget.
Yes.
Is that the way it was during your time?
To a certain degree. So in my era, the president was to examine the revenues, and we did this through the Secretary of the Treasury. So if the government takes in, let's say, $10 million of revenue per year, that's the revenue. You make that known to the Congress of the United States, and then you make recommendations about the best uses, in your own view, of that revenue, because the president is the sole officer of our national government who represents all of the people. The senators from Virginia represent Virginia. A congressman from Trenton, New Jersey represents his district, but the president is the sole figure who represents the entire body of people. In this case, in my administration, 6 million Americans. In your case, 340 million Americans. But the same principle applies. And so the president then has a unique view. He can see the whole culture in a way that perhaps a congressman from New Hampshire cannot, or a senator from Georgia cannot. So the president says, I think we should use our $10 million in revenue in the following ways. And he makes a kind of presentation to the Congress. Then the Congress takes over. They're sovereign in this regard. The president can't spend money. And so the Congress decides whether it wants to take the president's advice seriously or not, or if it wants to make adjustments. And of the two branches of Congress, it's the House of Representatives that takes the lead because Mr. Madison, the father of the Constitution, wisely placed all matters of revenue and war not in the Senate, but in the House. And why? Because the House of Representatives is that body of our national government that is closest to the sovereign, closest to the people. The Senate is at some remove, six-year terms, and in my time, the senators were elected not by the people, but by state legislatures. So the House is that body which really is most democratic with a small d. And that means that the House must be the entity that spends money because that money comes out of our pockets. And that House must be the one that declares war because war is the gravest thing that a nation can do. And it's going to involve my son or your son. And so this must be decided, as it were, by the people themselves. And the closest we have in our system to the people themselves is the House of Representatives.
Mr. President, back to the idea that your budget was a blueprint for what you wanted to achieve during your presidency. In your inaugural address, you listed what your principles were, and they included a frugal, limited government, reducing the public debt, a great respect for states' rights. You wanted to encourage agriculture, and you wanted a very limited government in people's lives, correct?
And one more thing, to reduce the national debt as close to zero as it was practicable to do during my time as president. Now, I would have liked to have eliminated all $80 million of Mr. Hamilton's national debt. I could not do that. You have to pay for some limited functions. And so the budget was $10 million per year. That was our revenue. And by the way, that revenue came from no internal taxes.
Yes, it would seem, Mr. President, that you were quite good at reducing taxes. What I read, there were hardly any taxes. You cut them all.
We cut all internal taxes.
And you let go or fired all of the tax inspectors.
Well, that not quite so, but I reduced the size of the Treasury Department somewhat severely because we didn't need those agents. You know, our revenue came from import duties on luxury items at port, and so we had to have port revenue agents, and from land sales in the West. Without any income taxes, which were not yet legalized by the Constitution, or property taxes or other internal taxes of any sort, we didn't need what you would call an IRS. And so I was able to reduce the number of officers of the government accordingly.
This must have made you quite popular with people.
Yeah, I didn't boast much in the course of my life because I always saw myself as a mere agent of the Enlightenment, as a spokesman for the people's interests. But I did say in my second inaugural address, what laborer, what farmer, what mechanic has seen a tax gatherer during this administration?
Albert Gallatin said, we must have a strong policy. The debt must be paid. If we do not do this, our children, our grandchildren, and many generations to come will have to pay for our mistakes. Mr. President, I've heard many politicians during my time say the exact same thing.
Of course, but we meant it. So we literally did reduce the national debt by $37 million by devoting $7.3 million per annum to debt retirement out of a revenue of $10 million. In other words, during my administration, we devoted 73% of the federal revenue each year to debt retirement. That's to be serious about fiscal responsibility and would have done more if we had been able to do so. And let me say that Madison, my closest friend, the Secretary of State, was concerned about these issues, but he was not in any way obsessed with fiscal responsibility. And I think he would have spent more in my administration than I was willing to do. But Gallatin was a severe fiscal conservative. And in fact, the only disputes that occurred in my cabinet during my 8 years, my cabinet was maybe the most harmonious in American history. The only disputes that ever occurred were between Gallatin and the Secretary of Navy, Robert Smith, because Gallatin was so great a revenue protector and a tax cutter and a debt retirer that poor Smith felt that the Navy simply couldn't hold on. It couldn't exist at all under the severe and draconian strictures of Albert Gallatin. And I understand Robert Smith's position, but I still think that Gallatin deserves credit because what for me was a principle was for him a fiscal obsession.
During my time, the president's budget has called for many things I think you would approve of, Mr. President. He's currently there are calls to reduce the debt. I don't know how successful that will be, but there's also a call to cut government severely. Maybe not severely by your standards, but severely. On the other hand, the current federal budget is calling for a huge amount of money put into defense spending.
Of course, the earth belongs to the living and not the dead. But from my perspective, I can say this. First, that the number one thing that a government must do is protect its citizens from improbable invasion. So a war department of some sort, a defense department, if you want to call it that, is essential. How big it should be, I can't say, but my own view is that it should be defensive only. We should have a defensive military establishment, but not an offensive one. We should protect our own coasts and harbors, but we should never carry war to the rest of the world. That's not America's interest. And so I would be for a very lean and exceedingly defensive War Department. The other things depend, of course, on the time and place in which you happen to live. Some functions are essential. You have to have a post office. You have to have a State Department. We need some diplomacy around the world. But the fact is that most things are unnecessary and therefore improper. And if you began in your time by saying we cannot run a national debt, that it's absolutely morally imperative that we balance the budget every year unless it's a time of national emergency, then you would find, I think, that you could live with a lot less government. The only reason that you are comfortable with as much government as you have is because you don't have to pay for it.
Well, we've sort of grown into it, Mr. President.
To be sure, you have, but it's a bad habit, my friend. When you have a deficit, it means that you can pay for things now by taxing the unborn, taxing your children and grandchildren.
Back to Mr. Gallatin's statement.
If you had to pay for them in your own generation, you wouldn't do it. And secondly, here's a much graver threat to the republic. When you have national debts becoming habitual and, in some sense, taken for granted, that gives the executive enormous, almost unlimited power of adventurism. If a president wants to fight a war and knows that he can use a national debt to fight it, that's easier than for him to come to the House of Representatives and say, I'm thinking of fighting a war. That means you need to raise $20 million in revenue. You'll have to do that before I send a single troop. That puts pressure on the House of Representatives, which has to answer to the people. And so as long as the people can control the spending of revenue through the House with a balanced budget requirement, the people are almost never going to go to war. But if a president doesn't need to turn to the people, if he can fight a war simply because he thinks it's a good idea, or he's responding to some private obsession or some moment of peevishness, then that's going to lead to unnecessary adventures in the international arena. We need to rein in the power of the executive by saying if you want to fight a war, you go to the House of Representatives, you ask for the revenue, and if the people decide they don't want to do it, you find some other path, sir.
Mr. President, I thank you for this conversation this week about the budget, and I'm surprised at your willingness to share all of this with us. In closing this discussion, I have read that contemporaries of yours were astonished by this president who had renounced all the practical tools of government. You gave up the army, the navy, taxes. It's like you were trying to create a kind of government that didn't exist.
I mean what I say, minimalism, protecting the pocketbooks of the citizens, the taxpayers, not spending money just because it might be fun, but only spending money that the citizens themselves have authorized me as the executive to spend.
But you let go of the army. You had the army at somewhere between 3,000 and 3,500 troops. You were down to 6 frigates in the Navy. You pretty much let go of all of that. How could you do that and not worry for the security of the nation?
Well, first of all, I think that large armies and navies are provocations to war. I think once we create those machines, then the natural desire is to use them. And so by reducing them, I think you you really give yourself the opportunity to pursue peaceful negotiation instead of war. But let me say this. I would have liked a national museum. The Lewis and Clark artifacts wound up being dispersed. I would have liked a national university. I had many projects. I could list dozens, even hundreds of things that I would have liked to do, but not until we have balanced the budget and eliminated the national debt. And secondly, not until we have amended the Constitution to give the national government such powers. Those powers were not enumerated by the Constitution makers in Philadelphia. And until such time as we amend that instrument to create a bigger, more proactive government, I will never abuse my authority to do things that I find desirable, but which are not enumerated in the first or second articles of the Constitution of the United States. It's really, sir, just that simple.
Were that all Americans so disciplined in their economic policies, Mr. President.
I appreciate it, and I know some of your listeners will think, well, what about the Louisiana Purchase? That's different. When Napoleon offers you an empire for liberty, you must accept it.
It's time for us to take a short break. When we return, we'll be speaking with the gentleman who portrays President Thomas Jefferson, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Hello, everyone. This is Clay Jenkinson. I want to invite you to participate in this year's cultural tour on the Lewis and Clark Trail. It's our 12th time for me going up the Wendover Death March. This is the trip that never gets old. It's the highlight of my year. You'll see why when you come 3 days on the wild and scenic White Cliffs area of the Missouri River, east of Fort Benton, and then 4 days up on the Lolo Trail, the most pristine part of the entire Lewis and Clark route that starts at Monticello and ends at the shores of the Pacific Ocean. This is my favorite of all the cultural tours. You can sign up. It's July 18th through 27th. You can find out details at Odyssey Tours or jeffersonhour.org. We want to see you on the trail, and I hope that you will take a look at this and other cultural tours. Thanks. We'll see you there.
Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. And now we shall have our weekly conversation with the gentleman who portrays President Jefferson, Mr. Clay Jenkinson, and it is he who is seated across from me now. Good day, sir.
My friend David Swenson, the semi-permanent guest host of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. You know, I think this is the strongest statement I have ever made as Jefferson for severe fiscal responsibility.
Which is what?
Is that the government should really only do a handful of things, and paying the national debt off was Jefferson's obsession. And, you know, we hear this all the time, but he meant it and he did it.
Well, you use that word just loosely, but you meant it. Obsession?
It was an obsession. So here's America's Da Vinci, who puts himself in a fiscal straitjacket as president.
And ended the last segment saying, I wish I could have had a national museum.
He wanted all those things. He's Da Vinci.
But he didn't do it.
Because he believed that the duty of the government, especially the national government, is to be minimalist. And that if the Virginia government wants to be a little more adventuresome, that's a question between that government and its own constituents. But that there has to be a severe limitation on federal authority. So Jefferson is maybe the most severe of all presidents in the entire history of the country on this question. But what I love about him, David, is that he practiced what he preached. This wasn't just somebody, as you said during the program, who says, we need to balance our budget. How dare we do this?
Well, I don't think I said it quite like that.
Jefferson said it, and he meant it, and he acted on it. And so when you think of his record of spending 73% of annual revenues on debt retirement, it's astounding. It's hard to even believe that that can be true.
He did get a little derailed by that during his two terms, but that was due to a war and an embargo act, which if we get caught in that discussion, then
that's a whole different story.
That's a whole other show,
But he is, without question, the most fiscally responsible and conservative president in American history. And then Madison, who was not quite as fiscally conservative as Jefferson, nevertheless felt compelled to follow in the master's footsteps and be a serious fiscal conservative himself. And so it wasn't until Monroe, in what is called the era of good feelings, that there was enough confidence and relaxation about revenue that he was able to engage in what were called internal improvements, roads and canals and bridges and so on. But even then, Jefferson, watching Monroe's internal improvements from Monticello, was disgusted with his protege and thought, you know, you help them into office, you teach them all that you can, but they follow their own path. And here's Monroe, who is spending money that is not really authorized by the Constitution of the United States on things that, believe me, they're desirable, but they are not essential. They're not necessary and proper. And so Monroe is straying from the cause, thought Jefferson.
What I found interesting was Albert Gallatin saying this: we must have a strong policy. The debt must be paid. If we do not do this, our children, our grandchildren, and many generations to come will have to pay for our mistakes. That could have been said yesterday and probably was.
That sort of rhetoric is used, but we don't mean it in quite the same way any longer. There is a portion of the House of Representatives that feel strongly this way, and they have been asserting themselves, and they have found Donald Trump to be a little disappointing already because he's not nearly as conservative and as fiscally careful as they are.
But there are things that Jefferson would approve of with Trump's budget, don't you
think?
Yes,
I think Jefferson wants to cut the budget. I think Jefferson would think, if he looked at our system, would think that almost everything is frivolous. But let me say this, David. The earth belongs to the living. Jefferson lived between 1743 and 1826. There was less at stake. We weren't an urban industrial nation. We weren't a nation of vast immigration.
What do you mean when you say less at stake?
Today, we live in a world where it's what Theodore Roosevelt learned when he was coming up, that if you have an urban system, those people can't provide their own food. They can't provide their own water. They can't provide their own fire departments. They can't provide their own policing. It's one thing to talk about this in Jefferson's world that's 97 or so percent agrarian. Once you create cities, you're in a whole different environment, and certain things in modernity with automobiles and airplanes and cruise missiles and tanks and nuclear weapons and so on require a much, much larger government than any of the founding fathers could ever have conceived of. And if you think you can govern the 21st century with a 18th century libertarian model, you're just nuts. And so the people in Congress today who have this view that we should be like the founders and we should be as conservative as the founders, I understand that up to a point, and I think that the national debt is out of control, and I think the U.S. budget is out of control, and a nation of entitlements is a nation that's going to have lots of fiscal trouble in the long run. But you can't believe that in the 21st century, given the complexities of our urban, industrial, mechanical, cyber civilization, that you can live with the radically severe minimalist libertarian government that Jefferson was talking about during his time. And so I think that lack of historical nuance or lack of historical translation capacity is the fatal flaw of that group of radical libertarians who are now having a stranglehold in some respects on the United States government. They think they're originalists, but they're also people who are flying in airplanes in a world of terrorism.
But you're not saying that we can't learn from Jefferson just because of that, are you?
No, we need to learn. I believe the core philosophy, which is that we should rein in the size of our national government. We should certainly balance the budget. We should not only balance the budget, but be retiring some of or all of the national debt. And we should let states be the laboratories of democracy to the extent possible and always ask ourselves when we're passing federal legislation, would this be better handled at a state or local level?
So let's simply state it then from you. What's not Jefferson?
What's not Jefferson is running up vast amounts of debt. What's not Jefferson is assuming somehow that using modern economics that running a national debt is somehow not necessarily bad as long as it's only a certain percentage of GDP and so on and so forth. What's not Jefferson is having functions of government. Take, for example, my favorite, the National Endowment for the Humanities. That's the subject of this week's essay. I love the National Endowment for the Humanities. It's an unbelievably interesting and important piece of our national system, and it's a mere pittance, David. It doesn't even register in terms of outflow of revenue. But from Jefferson's point of view, is it necessary? Of course not. It's part of the great society. It's part of what a very wealthy nation that loves the arts and loves culture does. But is it absolutely necessary? Of course not.
You know, I don't know. He did do things that were against the Constitution. He did do things that were out of his reasoning. He wanted an agrarian America, so he cut the price of public lands so that people could afford them. He bought Louisiana Purchase. You get my point?
I do, but remember when Charles Wilson Peale, the first great museum director in America, wrote to Jefferson from Philadelphia and said, Lewis and Clark brought back really great things. You know what? It's probably time now for a national museum to house such things. And Jefferson said, no, absolutely not. We're not doing it till we have A, a balanced budget, and B, a constitutional amendment authorizing it.
He pretty much during his presidency, correct me if I'm wrong, but he did not initiate bills to Congress, nor did he veto bills from Congress. And had he done that, couldn't he have made provisions for some of these things you're talking about?
Yes, if Jefferson had wanted a national university or a national museum, he would have gotten them. That's the point. He didn't. He wanted them, of course, in his dream world, in his utopia, but he didn't think they were proper functions of the national government of the United States without an enabling amendment and without the national debt having been paid off.
And he really didn't feel like that was his place to do it.
So he did a few little things. I mean, he's not always consistent, of course, and he was flexible. So when Charles Wilson Peel was doing a dig for mammoth bones in upstate New York, Jefferson didn't fund it the way we would with a National Science Foundation grant, but Jefferson sent him a Navy pump and said, there's a lot of water leaking into your dig. Here's this Navy pump. We're not particularly using it at the moment. You can borrow this pump. So there's a grant in a certain sense. He bought the Louisiana Purchase, which was technically unconstitutional, at least according to him, and then he sent Lewis and Clark. But when he sent Lewis and Clark out, he convinced Congress to fund it as a commercial enterprise under the Commerce Clause.
You know, we talked about this last week, and one of the things we didn't bring up, which you just did, is how cagey he was in approaching Congress to get money for the Lewis and Clark. And it wasn't that much. It was like, what, $2,500 or something?
But he also meant it. He meant that to extend the commerce of the United States, to get into the fur trade with Indians and to knock the British and the French out of the fur trade, or at least to get ourselves into the equation, it might be useful for the government of the United States to fund a little very inexpensive expedition to go out and pave the way for an American presence in the fur trade. So he used the Commerce Clause, and Congress debated it, and they said, sure, well, it's $2,500. We'll do this for Mr. Jefferson. Was there a little inconsistency there? Of course. Are we glad? Yes.
Yeah, I'm trying to understand the difference. Maybe you can help me. But was he just worried about setting a precedent by funding public arts or museums?
He's just that kind of a person. You know, he just is. There's an ideologue in Jefferson, and he really, really did believe that the states were more important and more legitimate than the national government. We don't agree with that in our time, most of us. And Jefferson believed that the national government would become an octopus that would strangle America if you let it. And of course, there's some truth to that. So, you know, I wish he'd been different. If you want the truth, I wish he'd said, you know what? I want a national university. I've reduced the national debt by $37 million. I think I'm entitled to that. I wish he'd said, I want the Smithsonian. I'm the most fiscally conservative guy around. If I want a museum for the artifacts of the Lewis and Pike and other expeditions, I want that. I wish that Jefferson had made a little wish list of Enlightenment, Da Vinci-like things and said, you know what? You're only president for one purpose, and that's to do some things for this country. And I get it. I'm a strict constructionist, and I'm not trying to aggrandize the size of government or blow the budget. But you know what? I have four or five pet things I want to do, and I'd like you to do them. And Congress would have done them, David. And because he didn't do it, we lost the Lewis and Clark Treasury. Those things were dispersed. Maybe the most extraordinary artifact base in American history was lost because Jefferson could not overcome his ideology on this question and just ask for a national museum, which Congress would instantly have given him.
I believe I've worked you up as much as I worked up President Jefferson.
Well,
I'm on your
side about this, but I'm trying to explain what Jefferson thought, not what you and I wish he had done.
Noted, sir. Now it is time for us to leave this part of the conversation. And before we go to the Jefferson Watch this week, you're traveling. In fact, you're going to Virginia. Do you want to tell folks about that?
I'm thrilled. On April 19th, I'll be at the Diamondstein Concert Hall in Newport News, Virginia. I love going to Norfolk, Suffolk, Virginia Beach, Newport News, etc. And I'll be at the Ferguson Center Wednesday, April 19th from 7:30 to 9. That's this April 19th, a Wednesday. And I just can't wait. I love that. I love going there so much, David. I have friends there, wonderful friends, old and young. I run into people in restaurants and in coffee shops and bookstores that say, hey.
Once again, Clay, the date you're going to be there is?
April 19th, 7:30 to 9 at the Diamondstein Concert Hall, Newport News, Virginia, the Ferguson Center.
And if people want to find out about that, if they go to jeffersonhour.com, they can.
There's a calendar and it's posted. Yeah.
But another one, too, we talked about it last week at length about, and that's your favorite tour of the summer.
Oh, the Lewis and Clark Cultural Tour on the Missouri River for 3 days in the Great White Cliffs section.
And again, if they go to Jefferson Hour, if you're interested, go to jeffersonhour.com and you can find out more about it.
4 days up on the Lolo Trail, and people can go to oddytours.net or jeffersonhour.com or org, and they can find out everything they need to know. But the dates are July 18th through 27th, so the last week in July. It's my favorite moment of the entire calendar, and everyone who comes says, why won't Swenson come? What's wrong with David Swenson? Does he not canoe?
Can't make it up the hill.
Right, yeah. So I hear.
Thanks for a great conversation this week, but now it's time for this week's Jefferson Watch.
Thank you, David. Thomas Jefferson would probably not have supported the National Endowment for the Humanities and the National Endowment for the Arts, at least in his own time. Don't get me wrong. Jefferson loved the arts. In his own state of Virginia, he wanted public libraries to have art collections that you could literally check out and display this painting or that sculpture in your own home for a time. He gave his life to the promotion of public education. In fact, he regarded his founding of the University of Virginia in Charlottesville as one of the three prime achievements of his life. Thomas Jefferson was America's Leonardo da Vinci. But Jefferson believed that a national debt is a national disgrace, and he believed that the national government should only do those things that were genuinely necessary and proper, as the Constitution puts it, and not that which is delightful, life-affirming, useful, or personally satisfying. He told Charles Wilson Peale, the father of the American Museum, that we must not contemplate creating a national museum of the United States, effectively our Smithsonian, until such time as we had paid the entire national debt off and passed constitutional amendments to authorize such things as a national museum or a national university. Okay, we get it. No president was as fiscally draconian as Thomas Jefferson. But that was then, and this is now. Now we have the CIA, the National Security Agency, billions of dollars of black ops that don't even appear in the budget of the United States. We have the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the National Institutes of Health, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, the National Forest System, National Monuments, and on and on and on. Some of these things can rightly be called Jeffersonian. Some are so dark that it would be a slur against Alexander Hamilton or even Aaron Burr to say that they might favor them. People often ask me, what is the most Jeffersonian thing in America? For me personally, above all else, it is the National Endowment for the Humanities. The National Endowment for the Humanities is that very thin gossamer of Jeffersonian thread that lifts our national culture to civility, nuance, context, thoughtfulness, and public engagement. The NEH costs less to run per year than any one of the dozens of weapons systems, from unnecessary tanks to the failed F-35 jet fighter program that the Defense Department itself asked Congress to cancel as inefficient, over budget, or no longer useful. My life has been marked. My life has been made by the existence of the National Endowment for the Humanities and its 57 state and territorial humanities councils. Imagine living 1 week without National Public Radio, 1 week without the National Air and Space Museum, without the films of Ken Burns, without that local ballet performance by young men and women who would have nowhere to develop their genius without that town's $2,413 grant from the Utah Arts Council. Do we absolutely need the NEH and the NEA? That depends on how you frame the question, of course, and what you think a great civilization needs. American civilization has been lifted immeasurably for pennies on the dollar, pennies on millions of dollars, given as competitive grants by the NEH and its state affiliates. To go after the NEH or the NEA or the Corporation for Public Broadcasting because we need to balance the national budget is insane. To go after these entities because some simpleton thinks that all art should be strictly private would be to deny the Vatican the Sistine Chapel, deny Florence its great David, Deny St. Louis the National Expansion Arch. Deny PBS the genius of our public history, Ken Burns. If you love the Thomas Jefferson Hour, you must fight to maintain funding for America's cultural agencies, for they truly are, in my opinion, the most Jeffersonian thing in America. I'm Clay Jenkinson. Join us next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.